Session number 27049.
Mr. Ray Hopewell, Reel 1. Can you tell me when and where you were born, Mr. Hopewell?
Yes, I was born in a village called Duston in Northamptonshire. It was about 3 miles from the centre of Northampton. And it was a village completely detached from Northampton when I was a boy in the 30s. I was born on the 17th of April, 1925.
And could you tell us a bit about your parents and your sort of family, your early years, your early family background?
Yes. I went to the local village school, which was a Church of England school.
Hang on, a bit about your family, though, first.
The family? Yes. My father was born in Duston, so he was local. My mother was born at Blisworth, which is, 4 or 5 miles away. My father, he worked in the shoe trade, and my mother, before they married, she was a domestic servant, and she was 19 when they got married. I think he was that little bit older. I think I was a love child, actually. Never mind.
Were they in steady employment during your time?
Yes. Once my mother married, of course, she didn't work. I think probably she did a little bit of part-time for somebody or other in the village. But my father was full-time. In the 30s, during the Depression, when they had it pretty rough in the cotton industry in the north, I can remember the boot and shoe trade were on 3-day weeks. So money wasn't all that prolific, you know, it could be tight. And that would have been the situation with practically all Northampton at that time, because it was essentially a boot and shoe town. It had very little other sorts of industry.
And did you have any brothers and sisters?
I had one brother. There's a year and 9 months difference between us.
Older or younger?
He's younger, yes.
And a happy childhood?
Yes, a very happy childhood. I suppose only lived a few hundred yards away from school. I used to go home at lunchtime for lunch every day at 12 o'clock.
Tell us about your education. Which schools did you go to?
It was Duston Church of England School. It's the bottom end of the village. So I used to be able to go home for lunchtime. And in those days we could go across the fields, birds nesting, and make trolleys and get them trapped into drains. And we used to go up a tip way out of the village that was flooded, and we used to tie drums together, and if our parents knew, they'd have had a fit.
Now, how did you do at school? I mean,
I also remember having one report, and it's the only one I remember, that said a little more persistence would give better results, which suggested I wandered a little bit.
did you have any particular favourite subject or subject you hated?
I don't think I hated any subject. No, it was a fairly normal schooling for that time. We all started the day with prayer and ended it with a prayer. The vicar came in once a week for half an hour, and we used to go across to the church, which was across the road, for Ash Wednesday and all these sort of things. There were only 5 classes in the school.
Now, how long were you there? You went?
Well, I started at, I think it was about 4 and a half when I started, and I left at 14.
So it was a single through school?
Single through school. There was a Northampton Grammar School at the time. Most children that went there were paid for. Their parents were in business. I think if anyone had a scholarship to the Northampton Grammar School at that time, when I was around, I would think only about 2 ever went there on a scholarship. They didn't, you know, it wasn't sort of open to all and sundry, although you had the scholarship test, very, very, very few, unless they were paid for, went to Northampton Grammar School. So I left school at 14.
Now, were you very interested in sport or anything else? You know, did any big hobbies or sporting interests?
No, I wasn't a great sports child, really. I was very interested in the countryside and what went on around, you know, and wildlife and this sort of thing. And we could go down to the mill fishing, and which we thoroughly enjoyed. Mill Lane, as it was then, it couldn't have been barely car width at the time. It's now dual carriageway because it's now been absorbed into Northampton. So the whole area has changed completely.
So you left school at 14. That would be 1939-ish.
That's right. Yeah.
And what before the war? I mean, just before the war broke out. Now, what job were you to go into? I mean, had your dad worked it out, or did you work it out, or what happened?
No, I went in. I went to Crockett and Jones, who are still in business, a boot and shoe firm in Northampton. They're still round. In fact, the property that we lived in at Spratton, I bought from Richard Jones of Crockett and Jones. He'd be the second or third generation. And I had it was office work within the factory. And I had a week in there. It was so noisy, and the smell of the leather and everything else. And I went home on Friday evening after this first week, and I said to my parents, I'm not going to stay there. I'm not going back. And they said, you know, you can't do this. You can't just jump about from job to job. I said, I don't care. I'm not going back. So what are you going to do? I said, oh, I should find something. And I had an uncle that was a baker and confectioner. And when I used to go, they lived at Oxford, and when I used to go and stay with them, I was always intrigued, you know, watching him and all the rest of it. I went into the bakery. And I went as an apprentice confectioner. And I stayed there until I joined the Navy.
Tell us a bit about the work as an apprentice confectioner. Was it confectioner or baker?
They did everything, really, from bread to pork pies, cakes, pastries. And they had two shops. One was in St. Giles' Street, which was a sort of upmarket street. So the bands that went round those cakes with their name on were different from the Sheep Street branch. But it was the same ingredients, and probably they charged another 2 or 3p more.
And what were the skills you were learning then? I mean,
oh, everything, right from everything, you know, making pastry and bread doughs and the whole caboose. And it was very rewarding. It was hard work, you know, for a 14-year-old kid, and you started at the bottom, but I quite enjoyed it, and people I worked with were okay. And
you were doing this until?
Until I joined up, until I was 18 when I joined the Navy.
So that would be 1943?
Yeah.
Now, so we'll go back slightly in the sense of, now, do you remember the sort of day, it's an old joke I know, the day that war broke out? I mean, did you hear the broadcast?
Yes.
What did you think the day war broke out?
I don't know what I thought. I forget what day it was, but I can remember being at home, and I heard it over the radio, and I think my mother was rather concerned, and I sensed, you know, this awful thing's going to happen, but I didn't think that I would be going to war because I was still quite young. I didn't think it would last that long, but of course it did.
Had your father served in the First World War?
No, he didn't. He missed it.
Did you have any? I mean, you're a country lad, and it was the countryside.
Yeah.
Though,
yes, it was.
Did you have any perception of what was going on in Germany, or Hitler, or Nazism, or anything like that? Or was it just very distant to you?
No. I used to read the newspapers even as a kid. You know, I think I was aware of, you know, what was happening when he invaded Poland and all the rest of it. You know. I think I could appreciate the seriousness of it all, but at that age I didn't think that I would ever become involved.
Now, how did it affect your lives? I mean, what about air raid precautions? Ah. Did you have the issue of a gas mask, the rest of it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we got issued with gas masks.
Tell us about how was it done, and what was the gas mask like?
Oh, what was it like? Well, I think I only ever put it on to test it, you know, when you had it and you carried it in a square, in a box, you know, around your neck, and you had to carry it about with you all the time. I think before I left school, war was imminent, and we were already told, you know, that there'd probably be evacuees coming to live in the village or in Northampton. And so we'd got an idea, you know, what was going to happen. And I can distinctly remember all the Northampton Corporation buses outside the station and over West Bridge. There'd be a whole queue of them. And all these poor kids with the teachers and that were just herded into these buses and driven off here, there and everywhere to be dispersed among the population.
In this area?
In this area. It's in the Northampton area and Duston. We had quite a number in Duston, and I think we did part-time. I think they did part-time school. I didn't, because I'd left by then, I think.
How were the children made welcome in Duston? I mean, you know.
Oh, I think people accepted them. I think they were probably more apprehensive than the locals. But I do remember we had, there was an empty house opposite us, which was commandeered, and they put two East End women in, and they'd got about 7 or 8 kids between them. They were the roughest people we'd ever seen in our lives. The women used to go out drinking and leave the kids, and oh, it was dreadful, you know. And I think it was a bit of a shock for the villagers. But my father's eldest sister, she had an evacuee he called Michael. He was just a single child, and she never had children of her own. And he was very, very fortunate. He was absolutely doted on. He didn't want for anything. And I think he kept in touch with her right up until the time that she died, I think. I couldn't tell you what he looked like now, of course.
Now, were there any air raid precautions in Duston? I mean, did you get a shelter?
No, we didn't. But my father and next door neighbour decided to dig an air raid shelter between them, in the gardens, between us. And they spent, I don't know how long, digging this thundering great hole. They lined it with corrugated sheeting and got a roof over it, and I think they topped it with turf and a bit of an eyesore, really. I think the first winter it rained, and I think the land was pretty heavy, and it was flooded continually, so you could never have used it if you'd wanted to. It's ridiculous. Now, Northampton didn't get bombed as such, but it had we did have air raid wardens, of course.
Was that for the blackout? Did you have
Blackout? Yes.
Tell us about the blackout. I mean, how did you do it in your house?
Oh, I think we had some wooden frames that were covered with a light paper that was tarred in between the layers, so that it excluded the light. So you had to clip them up and take them down. I think it also got some very heavy-duty curtains that would have done it. I remember my father-in-law, he was an inspector in the Manchester Police, and they moved down into Duston, just quite close to where I lived. He was injured in the Blitz and in Manchester. And they moved, and by the time they got down to Duston, must have been the winter time. And I can remember this warden shouting out and put the light out, and they're trying to get the furniture out of the van to take it indoors, and all they'd got was a potty little flash lamp, you know. They were very, very officious, this blooming chappy was. It was ridiculous. But we did have some incendiary bombs that dropped between on some bungalows between Northampton and Duston that were built just before the war and just completed. I think they cost about £350, the semi-detached two-bedroom bungalow. I think the houses were about £375 or something. And some incendiary bombs dropped and ruined these three bungalows. I don't think anyone was killed, but it was during that raid or round about that time, some incendiary bombs dropped across the fields, just on the fringe of the village. And Mr. Hobley, who was an air raid warden, nice chap, they went there to put out the thing, and he picked up what he thought was a hose, and his electricity cable became electrocuted, which was very sad. But other than that, I think Northampton came through pretty well unscathed.
Now, what about the effect of rationing? I mean, you worked in a baker's, or, you know, a confectioner's. I mean, how did rationing affect your family, and how did it affect your work?
Well, like all families, we were, you know, rationed, and my maternal grandmother was living with us at the time after her husband died in 1935, I think it was. And she couldn't really comprehend rationing fully. She couldn't understand why she couldn't have a little bit more butter or a little bit more sugar. But we sort of managed okay, you know. We kept a few hens, so we had eggs, but we were rationed with a feed for those.
Would you get extra from work?
I was able to a little, shall we say, which probably helped.
What kind of thing would you get?
What would it be? Perhaps a bit of sugar, a little bit of fat of some sort. But even there, you see, it was in short supply. Only, you know, whatever you made, it disappeared fairly quickly from the shop.
Did it affect your work, the way you worked? Or were you on the... You wouldn't see it because you were on the sort of baking side?
I was on the baking side. I wasn't at the shop side of it, no. But, no, we all came through. I can remember wedding cakes, they couldn't be iced with white icing. And I can distinctly remember them being covered in chocolate, coverture. And then you'd get the silver leaves and the flowers on, so you'd got the dark chocolate cake with the silver leaves on, which a bit tougher would be by today's standards, of course.
And were you weren't a member of the Home Guard or any military organisation?
Well, yes. As you know, during the war, all young chaps, girls for that matter, were encouraged to join the Army cadets, the Air Force cadets, or Naval cadets. And I chose to join the Naval cadets.
Now, when did this happen?
When would it have been? It was probably about 1940, I would think.
And where were the Navy
cadets? Let me think. 40. Yeah, I'd be about 16. Yeah, I was thinking it'd be about 1940,
41. Where were the Naval cadets based?
They were based at Campbell Square Schools in Northampton, which are now pulled down. And it's quite close to where the police and fire station is now. And we used to meet there, I think it was twice a week or three times a week.
Now, can you give us an idea of what a typical training night would be like? What training you'd do with it?
Oh, yes. We had uniforms, of course. They were First World War ex-naval bods. The commanding officer, I forget his name now, but he was a solicitor. And then there was Percy Strolger, he was one of the lieutenants. And then there was somebody, I don't know what he was, probably a gunner in the First World War. We did all the normal training that you would if you joined the Navy.
Tell us what you remember of it.
Yeah, tying knots, formal marching, rifle drill. I can't remember whether we had actually had rifles or whether they'd have broomsticks. I can't remember now. And signalling, you know, flag waving. I don't think we did Morse. But we had all the usual inspections and parades, and did all the sort of very preliminary training. The consequence of that, when I joined up, I didn't do one iota of training.
Now, hang on, you were doing that from 41 to 43, the Naval
Yeah,
cadets.
Yeah, a couple of years, yeah.
And anything happened or anything special about it? Or was it just a routine once?
No, it was a routine two or three times a week. And when we had a parade in the town to raise money for forces or whatever, we'd go out on this parade in front of the town hall and the mayor and all the rest of it. And I can remember my father saying that some of his mates had seen us, and they said, "Oh, the Navy lot, they were the best lot of, you know, of the three Army and the Air Force." Well, we would be, wouldn't we? And Well, and we went out to this the commanding officer's place at Flor. We did a route march one weekend, and we route marched from Northampton to Flor, which is going towards Weedon on the A5. And local villagers put us up over the weekend. I think we had to take a bit of rations of some sort or other with us. And then there was a dance in the village hall at night, and there was a parade at church on the Sunday morning. But it was a route march. How far would Lough Flor be? 5 miles, 6 miles, something like that.
Did you have any duties with the naval cadets? You know, any sort of guards or things that you had to do with them, or was it just a training process?
No, it's just a training process.
Now, tell me, how did you come to be called up? What was the process of you being called up? How did it run through? Or did you volunteer?
I volunteered.
Now, why did you volunteer?
Because I had a friend in the Sea Cadets who was being called up. And I decided to volunteer. A, because I wanted to go in the Navy anyway. I didn't want to be called up to go into any of the other forces. I think...
Now, why the Navy? I mean, it goes back to why the Naval Cadets as well. I mean, why not the Air Force? Why not the Army? What attracted you to the Navy?
I don't know. I was also attracted to water. If we went for a Sunday evening walk with my parents and there was a stream the other side of the field, I would go the other side of the field. But I can't account for that. I mean, living in the Midlands, right as far from the sea as possible, I think Skegness and Hunstanton were the nearest seaside resorts, to join the Navy from Northampton seemed a ludicrous thing to even think about. But
that's what you wanted to do?
That's what I wanted to do.
Now, was there any tests or anything you had to do to be accepted that you recall?
No.
Do you remember the medical?
Yes, I went for the medical, and... I joined up.
Now, when were you called up? After the medical?
It must have been beginning of September, I think, 1943.
When you were 18,
yeah. Yeah, when I was 18,
18
yeah.
And a half.
Well, 18 and a half by the time.
Now, where were you called up to go to?
I went to HMS Royal Arthur, otherwise Butlins, Skegness.
And what was your reception, you know, when you got there?
Yeah.
You know, you arrive as a civilian, don't you?
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, what happened when you first got there in September 1943?
Oh, I think you probably all heard it together and given a talk. You sort of measured for uniform and medical, and then you had an aptitude test.
Yeah, what about the uniform? What did they issue you with there?
Just a normal square ring, you know.
What was that? I mean, do you remember, or do you not remember what they gave you?
Oh, I think we had the whole works, you know, including the hammock and the blanket and you know, the cap and the whole lot, and underwear, boots, the whole caboose. I mean, it really kitted you out. I mean, you were in the Navy and you'd got everything, full stop.
And what about the aptitude tests?
Well, we all had to do that.
What were they looking for?
See where to place you, I suppose, to see where you would be best be suited as far as the Navy was concerned.
Do you remember the type of thing they were?
I can't really. It's been so long ago. I mean, you're going back 60 odd years.
So what happened then?
I think on the form, or when we went for the aptitude, they said, what branch did you want to go, you know, to join? And because I'd been in baking and confectionery, I said a cook, which I thought, you know, I know something about that, and I could do this. But in their wisdom, they decided I wasn't going to be a cook, I was going to be a coder.
Now, what do you think possessed them to think that? I mean, why do you think they picked you out for that? Did they tell you why?
No, they don't tell you anything. No, I think they probably thought he's sort of an average sort of chap that should be all right as a coder. Or perhaps they were badly in need of coders at that time, I don't know. They must have been.
Did you know what a coder was at that time?
I sensed what it was going to be, but I didn't know anything about coding or ciphers.
So what happened? I mean, you were at Royal... How long were you at Royal Arthur for?
10 days.
So just September, in fact?
Yeah.
Do you remember anything about... Did you do any training there at all?
No.
So what were you doing for the 10 days?
Well, it was like just doing tests, medical, kitted up. Can't remember doing any drill or anything. I might have to go to church on the Sunday morning if I was there on the Sunday morning, which I suspect I was.
How did you find the rest of your the fellow recruits, if you see what I mean? I mean, you know, it's your first exposure to them en masse. I mean,
yeah.
How did you get on with them? What did you think of their background and the way they behaved?
As far as I can remember, you know, they're just sort of normal sort of chaps. They'd come from all walks of life. One or two of them had obviously probably been to public school, I don't know, which was an issue. I probably never even thought about it. But, we were all in the same boat, and I said, you know.
No bullying?
No bullying.
So, what happened next then? Where were you sent to next?
I was sent to a place called HMS Cabala, Cabbala, I think it was. And it was at Lowton St Mary's, which is spelled Lowton, St Mary. It was near Lee in Lancashire. And I'd never been up north.
And you got there back end of September, or would it be into October?
It'd be back end of September, I suppose. I only did 3 months training completely, and I was out by Christmas, so it was probably mid-September, I don't remember. But this...
Now, what was your reception there? Yeah, I mean, you were saying it was up north.
Up north, yeah. Well, I think we went by train and got to Manchester Station. And this was strange. We got to Manchester Station, and the bloke, I suppose he was a petty officer, and was in charge of this group, I suppose it would be about 30 or 40 of us. The train to Lowton St Mary won't be until such and such a time, you can sort of wander around or whatever, you know. And there was about three or four of us, and one of them, he was a Northerner, and he knew Manchester, and he got us lost. So by the time we got back to the station, the train had gone to Lowton St Mary's with all the others. So we had to report to the military police on the platform. And they phoned through to the camp, presumably, and they put us on the next train available that was going that way. And having only been in the Navy about 10 days or so, we thought, God, we're going to be for the high jump. But we weren't. We were just received, and there was a meal waiting for us when we got there. Everybody else had probably eaten by then. But the camp, I think it is, I don't know what, it hadn't been built as a naval training camp, but it was built on clay. And the time I can remember being there, it was always wet. There was great puddles and, oh, God, what a blooming place to come to. We did have go to local dances.
Let's ask you, well, I mean, was it a hutted camp? What were the huts like?
A hutted camp? Oh, just normal, you know, bunk beds, very sparsely furnished. I think the camp had probably been built for land army workers initially. I don't know, but that's what it struck me as being like. And there was just the great central dining hall and kitchen and all the rest of it.
What was the food like, just to deal with it?
Oh, well, it was just food, I suppose.
Was there enough of it, or was it good quality, you know, good enough for you?
Oh, yes, I suppose so. No one complained. Well, you couldn't complain during the war, could you? You had to make do with what you could get.